Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Thanks, MOTAT. Have you heard that sting yet?
No, I haven't. That's the first time, yeah.
It's very exciting, isn't it?
It is.
New sponsors. Yay. Do you know what MOTAT is?
I do.
Okay, good.
Haven't been yet, okay. But I will.
Should check it out. It's very exciting.
I will, yeah.
All right, first story. A 12-year-old genius, or is this a dangerous thing?
I don't think it's dangerous. No, there's a 12-year-old boy who has become the youngest person to have done nuclear fusion in his bedroom, basically. This guy has managed to get... there's these hobbyist groups that are set up to encourage people to try this. It's not particularly dangerous, but it does require quite a bit of money. So he's obviously got a dad or mum who is willing to pay about $10,000. This kid was 10,000.
For what?
For all the equipment. So he bought a bunch of equipment from eBay.
Right.
Repurposed it, you know, made it what he needed, and built this little fusion reactor. Fusion is not like this. He's not going to make a bomb or anything like that. You know, countries are spending billions and billions and billions, trillions probably of dollars on trying to get fusion to work, and that's been, you know, on and on for many decades now.
Fusion as a source of energy, right?
Fusion as a source of energy, not a source of, you know, bombing things. Mm. So fusion power is really, really challenging to get, but it is this sort of ultimate goal of energy. It's the same power source that powers the sun. If we can harness it, it will provide virtually unlimited energy, which is almost entirely pollution free. So, you know, it's the holy grail. Yeah.
Pretty incredible. Okay, but so how did this 12-year-old kid do it?
Well, he did it by there are various, you know, little kits that you can build yourself, given enough money and enough power. He used quite a lot of power, 50,000 volts of electricity to get this little reaction to start. And the idea is that you have, it's really hydrogen, two different forms of hydrogen. Deuterium really is the main one, which is a slightly heavier type of hydrogen, still hydrogen. And you just need to crash these atoms together very, very hard, given enough energy, so 50,000 volts, and it generates what you do is you basically fuse the two atoms together. They generate another atom, which is slightly less. The mass of the new atom is slightly less than the sum of the parts, and that little deficit of mass turns into energy, and you release neutrons, which bombard, you know, the surrounding material or whatever. And if you can measure those, then you can prove that you've done fusion.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what would have been the effect in his bedroom? Did it get...
A big electricity bill, I think, is basically effect. I mean, there would have been very little that would have been seen, maybe spark or something like that. But
right.
There wouldn't have been any negative effects, really. You know, the high energy neutrons that fly out are pretty well absorbed by the surrounding material, and so this is not like nuclear fission, which has uranium and plutonium and really dangerous heavy sort of elements. Mm. Most of the things you can get fairly easily, even deuterium, you can buy pretty easily.
What?
Yeah.
Just buy it.
Yeah.
Just accessible. Okay.
Yeah, you can.
Wow.
Yeah, really. If you know where to look, yeah. There's chemistry. I could buy it from my chemistry lab.
Do you want to do a nuclear fusion reactor in the studio next time?
Have you got $10,000?
Okay. No. Well, so this is pretty incredible, though. For a young kid to
it
do
is.
Kind of on his own.
I think the incredible part is the age. I mean, this has been done before. Kids, not 12-year-olds, but, you know, several years older have done this. And, and there's certainly this group of hobbyists that are trying to do what, you know, the billion-dollar consortiums can't do. So I don't know, it's unlikely they're going to advance the field, but, you know, it's fun to try and show that you can actually do fusion.
Yeah pretty incredible. Okay. Yeah. Moving on to this, I mean, this news sounds sort of bad to me.
Yeah.
The climate change model was warning high carbon dioxide could suppress cooling clouds.
Take it with a grain of salt. So there's this pretty big grain of salt. Okay, so there's this report that's come out in Nature, one of the Nature journals, has started to model. So this is a modeling thing where most of the climate studies, it's big, big computational models where they take the atmosphere and all the dynamics and all the elements in the atmosphere and put it all together and all the heating and cooling effects and the solar radiation, all of it, and try and predict what the atmosphere is going to do. So this in particular focused on stratocumulus clouds, which are basically the low level cloud on a cloudy day, that, you know, overcast day. They're those big sort of deck of clouds that sit above your head. Yeah, and so they cover about 20% of low latitude oceans in particular, especially prevalent in the subtropics. And they hover in the sky and have this, you know, they create these overcast days. But they have a lot of value in warming and cooling, because basically they shade a lot of the portions of the planet from sunlight, and so they reflect it back out into space. But these, they're really, really difficult to model. And this is because, and you can sort of imagine why, the atmosphere is such a huge system. But if you were to take all the moisture in the atmosphere and condense it, it would only make a layer around the Earth less than a sort of a couple of centimeters thick. Okay. I mean, this is very, very little material compared to the rest of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Right. And of that, the stuff that makes up the clouds would be less thinner than a coat of paint.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
So there's very, very little stuff in such a big system. So to get the models working and to actually predict that, so they've been notoriously difficult to model. But anyway, these guys tried it, and built a sort of a model to try and understand these. And what the sort of their big headline result is, if CO2 in the atmosphere it reaches a certain level, then these stratocumulus clouds, this cloud debt becomes unstable, breaks apart, and the planet starts to warm a lot more. So they predict this sort of instability in the clouds triggers surface warming about 8 degrees C globally and about 10 degrees C in the tropics. That's huge. That is extinction level warming. Yeah.
So they actually do have a very important role in keeping the Earth cool.
Absolutely. They have an extremely important role. Now, one thing I omitted was, what is that level of CO2 that they're saying will do this? And there's probably a lot of uncertainty in this number, but it's 1,200 parts per million. Now, that doesn't sound a lot, but in right now, the level is about 400 parts per million.
Okay.
And it's only increased by about 100 parts per million in the last 100 years. All right.
Okay. So
given the worst possible, if we do nothing, if we continue growing and blah, 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 the projections are by about 2100. Is that the right way to say that? Yeah.
2100. Yeah.
there we will be about 800 parts per million.
Okay.
So it's getting there, but it's you know, it's a hard, you know, to
and
get to 1200.
And that's why you say
take
it with a grain of salt.
Big grain of salt. Now, there's probably a lot of uncertainty in that number, but, you know, you don't want to risk even getting close to that.
No.
Right? And if this actually happens, I mean, we may not be here to see that, but if this actually happens, then it's actually going to be really hard to get back down so that the clouds reform.
Yeah.
And so you have to go way down.
It'll take another hundreds of years to go back.
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
So
this is bad. It is bad.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But you're sort of saying that, I guess, because we are slowly making these changes and consciously like trying to undo the damage that we've done, that we probably would only be slowing down the sort of production of carbon dioxide rather than speeding that up.
Yeah, and if we try to adhere to some of the sort of global agreements that have recently been, like the Paris Accord and so on, then I think CO2's concentrations will have plateaued by about that year, in about 80 years' time, at about 400 and something parts per million.
Right.
So then they won't be down from today, which is sort of interesting, even though production of CO2 into the atmosphere might be almost nothing. Mm. But because it takes, the system is such a huge system, it takes a long time to change.
I'm going to hold you to that, Marcus. 2100, I'm going to say, Marcus said this.
I'll be back in 80 years.
No. Okay. No. Last story, though.
All right.
Now, this is, I mean, we've talked about CRISPR a lot.
Yeah.
But this story is about government funding being involved in CRISPR.
Yeah, so this is something I think I spoke about a few weeks ago, months ago, I can't remember, about a Chinese scientist who he sort of went rogue, or at least they're saying he went rogue, and he genetically modified two babies, mm-hmm. And they were born, and these are genetically engineered babies, and this is highly unethical, or at least most of the world think this is highly unethical. And so he did this, and they're saying, and he said that he did this independently, and no one else knew about what he was doing. And the Chinese, so he's a Chinese scientist, the Chinese government has said, we had no idea he was doing this. But the picture's getting a bit cloudier, because it turns out there's evidence that this work was funded by at least two or three government institutions in China who could well have known what he was trying to do.
Right.
And this includes the nation's science ministry, and they're funding these, they're calling these CRISPR babies. CRISPR is the technique that they use to do the gene editing.
Okay, so this is a problem, one, because that means the government lied when he got found out.
Yeah, but it's all, I mean, the big thing is,
and two, possibly, they were part of an
Chinese
unethical
authorities are funding
experiment.
This unethical research. Right. Yeah. And they're saying, well, maybe it's an effort because this big, big research could win Nobel Prizes and things like that.
Well, that's what I mean is this, I mean, the ultimate goal of CRISPR, well, at least, so I have a relationship to it in terms of Huntington's disease. I've talked about this a lot. My family has that. And the CRISPR technique could possibly be a solution to removing that gene,
sure.
Which is incredible, right? It's like this amazing thing. And so ultimately, there's a lot of people that may be relying on this. And so that, then we go back to the experiment with these babies, which is like you say, highly unethical. So what do we do? What's the next step?
Well, it's good. I mean, I think countries like China who have sort of issues with these ethical standards, the Chinese have, bioethics didn't take root in China until about 25 years ago. And since then, it's been trying to sort of catch up. It's trying to make laws and regulate sort of the rapid developments that have come along. But I think people are saying China's got to acknowledge there's a problem, and it's got to make sure that it polices the scientists that it's funding to do all of this research to make sure that they're not doing these unethical things. Mm.
Okay, complicated stuff.
Very.
Thank you, though, for coming in.
My pleasure.
And chatting. Yeah. And we will see you in 2 weeks.
Yep.
Yeah.
See you soon.
All right. Thanks, Marcus.
Bye-bye.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.